And that's exactly what they're doing. And this is what these elitist Jews are doing with Israel. Any time that they, you know, we point out their involvement and their, all the criminal things that they've been up to, and it's, oh, you're anti-Semitic, you're against all the Jews. No, we're naming names here. Do you see what I mean? We're naming names.
Yeah.
So if they choose to say that's anti-Semitic, there's not a lot we can do. We've named you the name, and it's as simple as that. And they just hide behind this thing, and then this has been behind their promote the political correctness and what have you as well. And the reason I'm keen on this quote is the way that he says, I created it, I alone, no one else has the right to tell me what to do about it. So he's not some benevolent benefactor creating this homeland for his people. He's a sly, manipulative individual that's got a plan for it, and it's certainly not to help the Jews, it's to help himself.
Well, we know that today as clearly as the nose is on our faces. So yes, we are working now into the 1905 period, where he begins to. Now this is interesting here. This criminal, Georgi Apollovich Gasparin, attempts to overthrow the Tsar. Now, Gasparin, is that the gas company Gasparin? I wonder.
Yeah, I never thought of that. I mean, it's Gapon here, G-A-P-O-N. I think that's G-A-Z.
Yes, yes, okay.
But it could still be linked. But the interesting thing here is not a lot of people are aware of this information, of this first attempted coup and to overthrow the Tsar of Russia. And, of course, 12 years later, we'll talk about, it succeeds. And the other interesting thing is that the coup fails and they flee to Germany where they're given refuge. And of course, we know what they get involved in Germany.
Yeah.
Making them the bad guys in a world war when Germany couldn't understand it, because Germany was the most friendly country to the Jews in all of Europe. They were very one of the most liberal countries, if you like, back then. So yeah, we've got an early example of that. It's certainly something worth looking into for people, the names there, if they want to do further research, so they can see that it was the same Jewish element that were trying to get control through communism 12 years before they actually did.
Well, we've got this 1906 period. Let's go into 1907, Rothschild, Jacob Schiff. Jacob Schiff, the head of Kahn Loeb Company. Now, Schiff, the Schiff family still runs big banking outfits in America, and they're still involved in the Federal Reserve. One of their children just married into Al Gore's family. You'll notice that these people were also the ones who seeded money later on, you'll read about, seeded money to send over a contingent of 4,000 plus into Russia to take over, was the Schiff people. That's Rothschild's henchmen. Why don't you read for us this 1907 thing? It says, unless we have a central bank.
Yeah, Jacob Schiff here. He's talking to the New York Chamber of Commerce, and he's the current head. Well, we know he's a Rothschild. It was a Schiff family, and the Rothschild family lived together in the house in Frankfurt. He said, unless we have a central bank with adequate control of credit resources, this country is going to undergo the most severe and far-reaching money panic in its history. And suddenly, same year, the financial crisis known as the Panic of 1907 happens, which is a depression itself that we don't hear too much about. And it goes on to decimate the lives of millions of Americans. So it's like, I'll give you the warning, I'll show you it happened, and then you're going to have to come back to me for my solution, because I gave you the warning, I made it happen, and you're going to have to accept my solution, which we will find out what the solution is very shortly.
Well, we're going to get in a little bit here now into 1909, and I want to talk about this, the school, Columbia University, being completely usurped by Jewish interests, as it is all the way up until today. There is virtually not a single department at that school that is not thoroughly and completely owned and operated by Jews. But all the way back in as early as 1909, we saw this happening, and it talks about a professor emeritus, Joel Springham of Columbia, became chairman of the NAACP and recruited for his board such Jewish leaders as Jacob Schiff, Jacob Bilikoff and Rabbi Stephen Weiss. Yep. So, you know, here we have the subversion of the black community and their original attempt to start manipulating racism within the nation.
Yeah, they need to create wars between people and then emerge as, to create strife within people and then feed off that. That's what they've always done with their wars and what have you. And this, the interesting thing here is the NAACP being set up by this group, and it's not actually until the 70s that the NAACP actually appoints its first black president, which seems absolutely mind-boggling when you consider the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People. You would have thought it would have been set up by coloured people, but they didn't even have a coloured black president until the 1970s. And this, when you look at the controls and essentially the divisions that these Jews have created between the two communities, encouraging rioting and what have you, through all the trouble that we had in the 70s, then it's very clear that they were up to their methods of creating conflict with these communities back then.
Well, and we still see the Southern Poverty Law Center being controlled by a Jew named Morris Dees. Still till today, there's been no change, and they're supposedly fighting on behalf of the African community in America. Now, let's go down here to see what these Talmudists believe about Jews. I mean, about blacks. In reality, here there's a quote from this Simon Wiesenthal Center director here, Brockman. And what did he write there, Andrew?
Well, he had a doctoral dissertation called, and I think you can find this on the internet, it's called The Ebb and Flow of Conflict, The History of Black-Jewish Relations through 1900s. It says there's no denying that the Babylonian Talmud was the first source to read negrophobic content into the episode by stressing Canaan's fraternal connection with Cush. This is biblical stuff we're looking at now. The more important version of the myth, however, ingeniously ties in the origins of blackness and of other real and imagined negroid traits with Noah's curse itself. According to it, this is the Talmud now, Ham is told by his outraged father that because you have abused me in the darkness of the night, your children shall be born black and ugly. Because you have twisted your head to cause me embarrassment, they shall have kinky hair and red eyes. Because your lips jested at my exposure, they shall swell. And because you neglected my nakedness, they shall go naked with their shamefully elongated male members exposed for all to see. This is out of their religious book, the Talmud.
And it's still in that book today, is it not?
Well, this is where I have problems with. I applaud, Jews against Zionism, etc., but I find it very difficult with some of these rabbis that can claim to be against Zionism, but at the same time promote, read, and preach the Talmud, because the Talmud has so many racist and very sickening parts to it that I can't see how the two can go together.
Yeah. Well, now here we got the Werner Schombart, The Jews and Modern Capitalism, states that from 1820 on it was the age of Rothschild, and concluded that there was only one power in Europe, and that is Rothschild. Do you want to read that quote? It's very powerful.
Yet, he says, Jewish influence made the United States just what they are, that is, American. For what we call Americanism is nothing else, if we may say so, than the Jewish spirit distilled. Modern capitalism is nothing more nor less than an expression of the Jewish spirit. Capitalism was born from the money loan. Money lending contains the root idea of capitalism. Turn to the pages of Talmud and you will find that the Jews made an art of lending money. They were taught early to look for their chief happiness in the possession of money. They fathomed all the secrets that lay hid in money. They became lords of money and lords of the world.
There you go. And Rothschild has made many quotable statements about he who controls the money controls the printing of the money, controls the government, and cares not who is in charge in any other sense. Now, let's go on to 1912 here, when Mr. Schiff is head of the great private banking house, Con Loeb. Now, where I went to school at NYU, we've got buildings at the university named Con Loeb. We have the Loeb building, and we have the Con, and we have, sadly, NYU is as much in New York City, as much controlled as Columbia, so I want to be an equal opportunity basher of this control that has been exerted on universities across the country, but let's talk a little bit about what these people are doing with the Harrimans and the Goulds and the Rockefellers.
Well, we've got, he was behind Standard Oil.
Yep.
And also involved with the Harrimans. And of course, they kept pushing the Harriman thing, these other so-called truth seekers out there, the Link, the Harriman Bush Link, and what have you. When you've got all these Bush bashers trying to say that Bush was responsible for 9/11 and what have you, and Prescott Bush was Harriman and all this, and Prescott Bush was aiding the enemy in World War II, etc. Well, yeah, these things happen, but why don't they want to talk about the Rothschild link to this, the Jewish link to this? It should give you evidence as to who to trust in this movement. But also the Rockefellers, of course, we know the links between the two of them. And they were very powerful in the railroad business, and of course the financial business in America at this time, and that's what this journalist George R. Conway states in this Truth magazine in December 1912.
Well, we've got the year America truly became enslaved, and that is 1913, and that is the year also that Wilson was blackmailed into silence and also into starting to put Jews into very powerful positions, including Supreme Court justice positions and so forth. Let's discuss for a moment what happened that year and give us an overview, and so people can read it themselves with the book, but give them an overview of what happened that year.
Yeah, briefly, this is when the Federal Reserve is set up. They'd already geared for this. We talked about the quote back in 1909 with the quote we just talked about with Jacob Schiff about the financial panic. Finally got what they wanted here. There's a lot of good, there's certainly Secrets of the Federal Reserve is a book that the first Eustace Mullins book that you can find on the internet in a variety of places that people can read more in depth on this. I think the listeners are very familiar with the setting up of the Federal Reserve. It's one of the first things that you learn when you look into this subject. Interesting quote, Charles Lindbergh, when the act of put the Federal Reserve in place, he said, and this was following the passing of the act on December, the act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this bill, the invisible government of the monetary power will be legalized. The greatest crime of the ages is perpetrated by this banking and currency bill. We've got some evidence who actually controls or owns the Federal Reserve, and we've got the Rothschild Bank of London, the Warburg Bank of Hamburg, Rothschild Bank of Berlin, Lehman Brothers of New York, Lazard Brothers of Paris, Kuhn Loeb Bank of New York, Israel Moses Banks of Italy, Goldman Sachs of New York, Warburg Bank of Amsterdam, and the Chase Manhattan Bank of New York, and these are all Rothschild-controlled institutions.
That's right, and then anybody out there who thinks the Rothschilds have waned in their influence, please wrap your brain around these facts, and you'll understand the truth. 1914, start of World War One. This was the first of a series of wars that they had planned. If you go back and look at some of the planning, they had talked in one of their henchmen, Albert Pike, discussed the fact that three wars would be needed in order to bring the world to heel on behalf of world Zionism. So the first of those wars, and of course the Rothschilds used Wolf to manipulate the German people into a fervor for war. Now, of course, there's no surprise here that you see Rothschild fomenters out over in Berlin pushing this idea.
Well, yes, and they've done it through their news agencies. Wolf, which was established in 1849. Reuters, we've already discussed when they got control of that. That was established in 1851. And Havas was established in 1835. And that's in order of the German, the English, and the French news agencies that they're all in control of. And so all they need to do is use all of those to say how bad the other sides are to get people into further for war. And this is one of the early examples of how valuable their control of the media was, because if you can control the information, then you can control the people through the information. Because if you can tell people you're being threatened by this, that and the other, your family's being threatened, then, you know, men will go up to their nearest military recruiting office and say, I want to sign up for a lot to fight in this war to protect my family. And that's exactly what they were doing here.
Well, Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, a Zionist Jew out of Greece who was put in control of the Ottoman Turk Empire after the caliphate was unceremoniously destroyed and his government was subjugated by the Young Turk Jewish Revolution. So that also took place in 1915. Let's go on to 1916 and talk about Brandeis being put in. Now, this is his first major position in the judiciary going to into the hands of Jewish interests, is it not?
It is, yes, and this is all to do with this this Untermeyer blackmail is still going on that we just touched on. The interesting thing here is that he's appointed to the Supreme Court. And he's also the leader of the Executive Committee for Zionist Affairs. Now, this is in the middle of the First World War. And Brandeis actually sends a Zionist delegation from America to Britain to promise to bring America into the war on the side of the British, providing the British give agree to give the land of Palestine to the Rothschilds.
That's that is the, and you can do the announcement, that is what?
Well, that is the Balfour Declaration that they used to do that, but that is what the war was about.
That's right.
And the thing is that they had settlements that they were building up there, but they needed the land. They needed a nation. They want their own nation. The deal is agreed, and America enters the war. And that same year that Woodrow Wilson was elected, he said, re-elect. His slogan of his campaign was re-elect the man that will keep your sons out of the war, and the same year he takes them in. But the thing is, the interesting thing, sorry, no, he takes the world in the following year on April the 6th. But the interesting thing here, and I'll quickly read the Balfour Declaration, because this is what, and people can see what it says and what Israel actually is. Now, the Balfour Declaration, dated November 2nd, 1917, I think the key part of the Balfour Declaration is the first line, Dear Lord Rothschild.
Yep.
So if that doesn't tell you who controls this, nothing will. So I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government that the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view would favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you will bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour. Now, the interesting thing here is the agreement is establishing a national home for Jewish people in Palestine, and it says, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. which of course we know what they've done to the Palestinians and continue to do, and also it says all the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Well, we see what they did to the Jews in Germany in World War II in order to drive them out of Germany and make them come to Palestine. So they betrayed the two agreements within that in no time at all.
Well, it's interesting here that the government in the United States was informed of the crimes being committed by the J.P. Morgan organization and Pierpont Morgan's frontman status for Rothschild. And what is known today is that when Morgan died, he was not a pauper, but he was not nearly... before his death, everyone thought he was the wealthiest man in America. In fact, he was only a standard run-of-the-mill millionaire at that point, as opposed to a billionaire, as everyone thought, because all the money he had was actually Rothschild front money. And he was outed by this man named Oscar Calloway, and it made no difference, did it?
Well, yes, and he's actually got a... He's a congressman, and he stated about this. He said in March 1915, the J.P. Morgan interest in the steel, shipbuilding, and powder interests and their subsidiary organization got together 12 men high up in the newspaper world and employed them to select the most influential newspapers in the United States and sufficient number of them to control generally the policy of the daily press. So we've already got him saying here that J.P. Morgan is a Rothschild fund. But again, they've used J.P. Morgan to get control of the media. They won't do it as Rothschild, but he's exposed the fact that they are Rothschild fund, because what they're doing is, if they do get exposed, it'll be, oh no, it's all American guy doing it, J.P. Morgan. But anyway, he goes on to say, they found it was only necessary to purchase the control of 25 greatest papers, so an agreement was reached. The policy of the papers was bought to be paid for by the month. An editor was furnished for each paper to properly supervise and edit information regarding the questions of preparedness, militarism, financial policies, and other things of national and international nature considered vital to the interests of the purchasers. So here we have the real cementing of media control in the US, and I think it's no surprise here that they've seen how well their control of the news agencies in France, Germany, and England has gone during the First World War, that they got control of this at a similar time.
Well, you'll also see at this time where Metro Goldwyn and Mayer and the Zolnick brothers and the Warners were also beginning to take their first major interest in film production, and silent films were starting to seriously become part of the daily diet of the world, especially Americans, and they went headlong into that as at the same time as taking over these other things. So basically, the two main organs of presentation, the daily newspapers and the film industry, were already controlled by these people. So let's go on to 1918 here. And it talks a little bit about the Petrograd report in the New York Times on January 30th. It says the People's Commissary have decreed a state monopoly of gold. And go ahead and tell us what this is about.
Yeah, what we've got here is this is just after the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yep.
And it was a declaration regarding the sealing of the wealth of the people for the benefit of the state. And the dispatch from Petrograd said, the people's commissaries, the people in charge of Russia, the Zionists, have decreed a state monopoly of gold. Churches, museums, and other public institutions are required to place their gold articles at the disposal of the state. Gold articles belonging to private persons must be handed over to the state. Informants will receive one-third of the value of the articles. So, it's quite a good deal that I think Jacob Schiff got for his $20 million, that he could get all the gold of the country for a third of its market value.
Yeah, well, that's how it always works out, doesn't it? Let's go on to the 1919 here in our last year, where we've got Bernard Baruch involved. We've got the Versailles Treaty going down here. We also had Benjamin Friedman present at this signing. Mm-hmm. It was his real introduction to this criminal outfit, and so he really knew what was going on with this. But this was an attempt to marginalize any hope for Germany to ever regain stability after World War I, and thus ensuring a subsequent second war, especially if they supplied the capital for it to remilitarize. And so, basically, why don't you give us a little rundown on 1919?
Well, firstly, Darrell, I'd like to say fully endorse and very helpful in the research was the Benjamin Friedman that you introduced me to your site. I know that you promote it a lot, and it's absolutely essential for all listeners to hear that.
Yep.
And the other thing, what you just stated about it really being this treaty, if you like, being so bad that it was going to lead to a Second World War, would have to lead to a Second World War because the treaty was so bad. And Eustace Mullins talks about this a lot when he discusses this period of history, that this Versailles Peace Conference was basically set up to make sure there would be a Second World War.
Well, and all they needed to do at that a couple of years later was provide Germany with funding to build their own armaments, because the anger and the seething anger under the surface was already there. All they needed to do now was to exacerbate those things with money, and you were guaranteed to have another war.
Oh yes, and the other thing that they did here was they ensured that your regular Jews in Germany were going to feel the hatred of German people, because the Germans felt they'd been betrayed by the Jewish population.
Yes.
Because of course they realized that the reason they'd lost this war was because America had been brought into the war, and it gave the British, the Allies, if you like, the additional military might to defeat the Germans. And they found that the only reason that had happened was the British had promised a land to the Jews, if you like. That was the way that they saw it. And when Germany had, as I stated before, they were the most friendly country in the world towards the Jews, and they had the Emancipation Edict of 1822, which guaranteed Jews in Germany all civil rights enjoyed by Germans. So, you know, this is really to foment the distrust of Jews in Germany by the German population. Another point here on the
CFR and the round table.
Yeah, we've got the CFR and the round table coming up here. A lot happens in this year. It starts off, it's actually a spin-off of the Versailles Peace Conference, which was chaired by Edmund de Rothschild.
Yep.
The guy responsible for Israel, again. He set up an organisation called the Institute of International Affairs, which would break up into, the British side is the Royal Institute of International Affairs, set up in 1920, and in 1921 the CFR. And of course we know what these people do, passes on down from there to the Bilderberg Group and what have you. It's just another two things. It's a buffer, so if people look, some people only get as far as the CFR and the Bilderberg Group, and they see it as just a bunch of industrialists controlling the world. And also it's a way of getting any up and coming people, of course, you know, we've discussed before all the certainly Clinton, Tony Blair, what have you, were at Bilderberg meetings prior to being appointed leaders of their respective countries when they were literally just plucked out the air beforehand. So we're aware of their power. They also, with this Versailles Peace Conference, tried to set up the League of Nations, which wasn't accepted by any countries. The Nahum Sokolow, who would go on to be the president of the World Zionist Congress, actually said the League of Nations is a Jewish idea. We created it after a fight of 25 years, which is interesting in the date, because that kind of fits in with when the first Zionist Congress was held.
Well, let's go on over here to end Alexander Solzhenitsyn, when he talks about the Jews setting up these internment camps to kill non-Jews, because you have a page 79 where he actually points the finger directly at them.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He
wrote the Gulag Archipelago, because I did speak about them recently as well.
Yeah, he basically, what Solzhenitsyn said, he affirmed that the Jews created and administered the organized Soviet concentration camp system in which tens of millions of Christians and non-Jews died. And on page 79 of his book, he named the administrators of these camps. He said they are Aaron Saltz, Yakov Rappaport, Lazar Kogan, Matvei Berman, Gonrich Yagoda, and Naftali Frankel. All six were Jewish. We talked as well about, you could look at the concentration camps set up for Germans after World War II, and a good book for that are the James Back books. One of them's called Other Losses, which is all about I think the book to read is actually Other Losses, which is all about the concentration camps after the war that killed millions of Germans, and these were set up by Russia and administered by Jews.
Yeah. Well, Bolshevism, okay, so we get into Scotland Yard report following the American Secretary of State. There is now definite evidence that Bolshevism is an international movement controlled by Jews. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, yes, they've said is, of course, there was, we know already what Winston Churchill wrote about in 1920, about it being administered by Jews, but here we have our security services in this in Britain, and they go on to say that communications were passing between the leaders in America, France, Russia, and England with a view towards action against the fact that Bolshevism was Jewish and needed to be and represented a danger to the world. But of course, because America, France, Scotland Yard aren't aware of this or the people doing this, but of course the government's well aware of who's in charge of them, which is the same Jewish group, and so of course nothing is done. And even if we go on and say that the Australian Prime Minister is quoted with the statement in the Saturday Evening Post, the Montefiores have taken Australia for their own, and there's not a goldfield or a sheep run from Tasmania to New South Wales that does not pay them a heavy tribute. They are the real owners of the Antipodean continent. What is the good of our being a wealthy nation if the wealth is all in the hands of, he says here, German Jews? And so it just goes to show that it's all about money, and who controls the money controls the country, as Rothschild said many years before.
Well, you know, Andrew, we've gotten through 1919, and it doesn't get any less interesting as we go back in history. In fact, it becomes clearer to everyone listening, and anyone who knows the history itself, that this is a seamless story. There is virtually not a single year where there's a break in this history all the way to the present. And as we can tell today, things are hotting up for another terrible event on our horizon here that is just going to forward this sickness into a deeper pit. And they are moving toward controlling everything, more so than they ever have. And I'm wondering whether, we're going to get enough people interested in these facts in time.
Yes, I think, we discussed this earlier in the week, but I think this is the problem. I can't think of anything else that we can do apart from just try and wake people up. So we do these shows, and you do a lot of shows with some other good guests, and I wish I could think of anything else that I could do, and I would welcome suggestions by people to try and, wake people up to this, because it just gets worse and worse on a daily basis, and it's very frustrating when we know who's behind it, but we are in the great minority.
Well, I am a marginal organization, and any 5 or 10 euro or dollar per donation goes directly into our battle here, keeping this thing going. So if you've got a dollar or 5 or 10, throw it in an envelope and send it to us, please. It'll help us continue the fight. And, Andrew, I want to thank you again for coming on and doing this next segment. We've got, I think, two more to go.
Yes, just two more.
Two more.
I'd encourage people to as well support. You've just put another book up, I see, on the site.
Yep, another. Well, actually, it's more of a short missive, if you will.
Oh, right, okay, yeah, I've still got to get round to looking at that. But, I mean, I just encourage people, there's only two more segments of my book got to go up there, and then all that will be online for free for people to read. So there's links there on if you want to come to my site. I've actually got 5 copies left of my first edition. And after that, I've got the Tex Mars edition. I've got a few copies of those, and then I think I'll probably pull the... I'll stop selling them myself. The ones that people buy from me go out signed, but once they've run out, people will still be able to get it on Amazon or from Tex Mars or what have you, so it's still going to be out there. But I would encourage people, there's a PayPal button on the French Connection, to donate to Daryl's site. It's certainly, from my perspective, there's very few out there that are doing the work that Daryl's doing. And if Daryl wasn't out there, I don't know really who'd be doing this sort of work, and Great Voice will have been lost, and an opportunity to wake people up will have been lost. So I encourage people to support this site before they think of buying my book.
Well, thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it. I'm going to let you go and have your evening, and I thank you again, my friend.
Yeah, thank you, Dale.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is all we're going to bring you today on this subject. It was a powerful example of this crime wave that we've all been experiencing, and it's time for every one of us to put our best efforts into getting more people to read these accounts and learn about this conspiracy. Take care of your families, ladies and gentlemen. Take care of yourselves, and be well. Bye-bye now.